Now, on BBC Radio 4, our classic serial, and the search for the Moonstone moves to London.
The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, dramatised by Doug Lucy. Episode 3.
Yes.
Is Lady Verinder in residence?
She is.
Then would you kindly inform her that her niece, Miss Drusilla Clack, declines to disturb her ladyship and merely begs to know whether she can be of any use.
Please wait here.
I was accidentally passing Aunt Verinder's house in Montague Square, London, on July the 3rd, 1848, and seeing the shutters opened and the blinds drawn up, decided to make inquiries. The insolent girl who took my message and left me on the doorstep is the daughter of a heathen old man named Etteridge, tolerated in my aunt's family at their house in Yorkshire. While I waited, I took from my bag a Christian tract addressed to young women on the sinfulness of dress. Its title was A Word With You on Your Cap Ribbons.
My lady is much obliged and begs you will come and lunch tomorrow at 2.
Thank you. Will you favour me by accepting a tract?
No, thank you, miss. Goodbye.
After the door was shut on me, I slipped the tract into the letterbox and proceeded to my destination, a meeting of the Select Committee of the Mothers of Small Clothes Conversion Society. The object of this excellent charity is to rescue unredeemed fathers' trousers from the pawnbroker and to prevent their resumption on the part of the irreclaimable parent by abridging them immediately to suit the proportions of the innocent son. I mention the society here because my precious and admirable friend, Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite, was associated with our work of moral and material usefulness. Has Mr. Ablewhite been in recently to oversee the efforts of our ladies?
Oh, Miss Clack, have you not heard the news regarding Mr. Ablewhite?
What news?
Well, last Friday, Mr. Ablewhite was exiting a banking house in Lombard Street and happened to engage in a brief conversation with a stranger by the name of Septimus Luker, as to whom should go out of the door first. They shared a few civil words, bowed, and parted in the street. On returning to his lodgings, Mr. Ablewhite found a young boy with a letter waiting for him. The letter asked him to visit an old lady who shared his philanthropic ambitions.
Such incidents are not uncommon, I'm sure, in Mr. Godfrey's large experience as a promoter of public charity.
Oh, undoubtedly so. And he wasted no time in presenting himself at the address in the letter. Here, he was shown to an upstairs room containing an ancient Oriental manuscript open on the table. He was looking at the book with his back towards the door when he felt himself suddenly seized round the neck from behind.
No.
Yes, he had just time to notice the tawny brown colour of the arm around his neck before his eyes were bandaged and his mouth was gagged and he was thrown helpless on the floor by two men while another rifled his pockets and searched him without ceremony.
How terrible!
The attackers then spoke to each other in a language which he did not understand and left.
Oh, man! Is he harmed?
No, and nothing was stolen either. The miserable wretches took only their Oriental manuscript with them. Next came news that exactly what had happened to Mr. Godfrey in Northumberland Street now happened to Mr. Luker in identical circumstances in Alfred Place. The only difference was that the strangers took away one of Mr. Luker's papers, which acknowledged receipt of a valuable of great price, which he had that day left in the care of his bankers.
What does it all mean?
Nobody knows.
I presented myself next day for lunch at my aunt's, where I found her anxious over the state of her daughter Rachel's behaviour, which was unladylike and painful to see.
Mama, do you think Godfrey might call today? I'm so full of anxiety and excitement on his behalf that I can barely contain myself until his arrival.
Remember what the doctor told you, Rachel, about quieting yourself with a book after taking your meals.
I'll go into the library, Mama. But if Godfrey calls, mind I am told of it. I'm dying for more news of him after his adventure. Goodbye, Clack.
When we were left by ourselves, my aunt told me the whole horrible story of the Indian diamond.
People are now speculating that what happened to Godfrey and the other man is somehow connected to the loss of the diamond.
Oh.
And poor Rachel is most dangerously excited about it
but
all.
But here surely is a case for a clergyman, if ever there was one yet.
Well, the doctors recommend plenty of exercise and amusement for her and urge me to keep her mind as much as possible from dwelling on the past.
Oh, what heathen advice. Your knowledge of the world, dear aunt, is superior to mine, but there must surely be a reason for this extraordinary conduct on Rachel's part. She is keeping a sinful secret from you and from everybody. May there be something in these recent events which threatens her secret with discovery.
Discovery? What can you possibly mean?
Well,
come.
Begging your pardon, m'lady, but Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite is here.
Oh. Show him in, my dear. Then tell Miss Verinder of his arrival.
Yes, m'lady. Sir.
Oh.
My dear Godfrey, how are you? How is your health?
How is your health after your brush with danger?
What have I done to deserve all this sympathy? My dear aunt, my dear Miss Clack, I have merely been mistaken for somebody else. Yet I have become the property of the newspapers thanks to Mr. Luca making our injuries public. And how is dear Rachel?
She is well and keen to see you.
Oh, I am glad to hear it. And Miss Clack, I am sadly behindhand with my committee work and my dear ladies. Did you make cheering progress at Monday's committee? Was the board hopeful about future prospects? And are we nicely off for trousers?
Well, in truth, we are almost too nicely off for trousers, being quite overwhelmed.
I am charmed to see you, Godfrey. Tell me the whole of the Northumberland Street story directly. I know the newspapers will have left some of it out.
Dearest Rachel, the newspapers have told you everything, and they have told it much better than I can.
Godfrey thinks we all make too much of the matter. He doesn't care to speak of it.
Why?
Rachel, darling, true greatness and true courage are ever modest.
You are a very good fellow in your way, Godfrey, but I'm quite sure you are not great. I believe you have some private reason for not talking of your adventure, and I mean to know it.
Dear Rachel, I am tired of the subject.
But have the police done anything?
Nothing whatever.
I suppose the three men who laid the trap for you were the same three who laid the trap for Mr. Luca?
No doubt.
And it is thought, is it not, that these three men are the three Indians who came to our house in the country. Do you think so too?
My dear Rachel, they blindfolded me before I could see their faces. I know nothing whatever of the matter. How can I offer an opinion on it?
Mr. Luca was robbed of a receipt, was he not? What was the receipt for?
For a valuable gem which he had placed in the safekeeping of the bank.
Did the receipt mention what the gem was?
No.
Well, some idle people are trying to trace a connection between what happened at our house in Yorkshire and what has happened since here in London. And the people who say that the three unknown men who ill-used you are the three Indians also say that the valuable gem...
Please, Rachel, say no more.
Tell me plainly, Godfrey... Do some people say that Mr. Luca's valuable gem is the moonstone?
They do say it. But Mr. Luca has sworn over and over again that until this scandal assailed him, he had never even heard of the moonstone. Yet these vile people decline to believe him on his oath. Shameful, shameful.
Considering that Mr. Luca is barely known to you, you take up his cause rather warmly.
I hope I take up the cause of all oppressed people rather warmly.
You have told me what scandal says of Mr. Luca. What does scandal say of you?
Rachel.
Don't ask me.
I will hear it.
Oh, tell her, Godfrey. Nothing can do her such harm as your silence is doing now.
If you will have it, Rachel. Mm-hmm. Scandal says that the moonstone is in pledge to Mr. Luca and that I am the man who has pawned it.
Mama! Hear what I say, Miss Clack. Hear what I say. I know the hand that took the moonstone. I know.
What?
I know that Godfrey Ablewhite is innocent.
Rachel, dearest, you must not appear publicly in such a thing as this. Your reputation is something too pure, too sacred to be trifled with.
My reputation? I am afraid, Godfrey. I have not done you justice hitherto. In my thoughts, you are more unselfish. You are a better man than I believed you to be. Come here when you can, And I will try and repair the wrong I have done you.
I will come, dearest, on condition that we don't speak of this hateful subject again.
Come.
Miss Rachel's friends are here to take her to the flower show, m'lady.
Mama, before I go, I have not distressed you, have I?
No, my dear. Go with our friends and enjoy yourself.
Take with you, cousin, my pity and compassion for your sad condition.
What do you mean by pitying me? Don't you see how happy I am? I'm going to the flower show, Clack, and I've got the prettiest bonnet in London.
Aunt, rest assured, any trifling inconvenience that I may suffer is as nothing compared with the importance of preserving that pure name from the contaminating contact of the world.
Oh, thank you, Godfrey. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm feeling a little tired.
Oh, of course. Till next time, then. And, Miss Clack, till our next committee meeting.
Goodbye.
Ladies.
Drusilla, yeah. Pour me a glass of water, please.
Of course.
What is that, Aunt?
Medicine, prescribed by my doctors.
Are you not well?
Will you wait here with me until Mr. Braff, my lawyer, arrives, Drusilla? He will be here at 5 o'clock. You can be one of the witnesses when I sign my will.
Your will?
Come and sit, my dear. I have been seriously ill for some time past, without knowing it myself.
Oh.
I may live for some months, or I may die before another day has passed over my head. My one great anxiety is that Rachel should be kept in ignorance of the truth.
Yes.
She would blame herself, poor child, though the doctors assure me that the trouble began at least a year before all the trouble with the diamond. Yeah. I'm sure you will keep my secret, Drusilla, for I'm sure I see sincere sorrow and sympathy for me in your face.
My dear aunt, I possess a library of works, all suitable to the present emergency, all calculated to convince, prepare, enlighten, and fortify you. You will read if I bring you my own precious books.
I will do what I can, Drusilla, to please you.
Not a moment to be lost. I will hurry home to collect the first series of readings and will be back in time to sign the will. There's not a moment to lose. When no interests but my own are involved, I am humbly content to get from place to place by the omnibus. Permit me to give an idea of my devotion to my aunt's interests by recording that on this occasion I committed the prodigality of taking a cab. I drove home, selected and marked my first series of readings, and drove back to Montague Square with a dozen or so works in a carpet bag.
My lady is shut up in a room with the doctor. She asks that you wait in the library with Mr. Brough.
Thank you.
This way.
Have you come to stay here, Miss Clagg?
Pardon?
That's a heavy-looking carpet bag you have there.
My aunt has informed me that she is about to sign her will. She has been so good as to ask me to be one of the witnesses.
Aye, well, Miss Clagg, you will do. You are over 21, and you have not the slightest pecuniary interest in Lady Verinder's will.
Not the slightest pecuniary interest in Lady Verinder's will. Oh, how thankful I felt when I heard that. If my aunt, possessed of thousands, had remembered poor me, to whom £5 is an object, if my name had appeared in the will with a little comforting legacy attached to it, my enemies might have doubted the motive which has loaded me down with the choicest treasures of my library and had drawn upon my failing resources for the prodigal expense of a cab. Oh, surely, surely. Much better as it was.
Well, Miss Clack, what's the latest news in the charitable circles? How is your friend, Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite, after the mauling he got from the rogues in Northumberland Street? Gad, they're telling a pretty story about that charitable gentleman at my club.
I live very much out of the world, sir, and I don't possess the advantage, sir, of belonging to a club. I happen to know the story to which you allude, and I also know it a viler falsehood than that story never was told.
Yes, Miss Clack, you believe in your friend, natural enough. But Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite won't find the world in general quite so easy to convince as a committee of charitable ladies. Appearances are dead against him. He was in the house when a diamond was lost, and he was the first person in the house to go to London. These are ugly circumstances, ma'am, viewed by the light of later events.
And what do you mean by later events, Mr. Brown?
I mean the events in which the Indians are concerned. Whom did they seize and search? Not Mr. Luker only, but Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite as well. The Indians were so uncertain as to which of the two had the disposal of it that there was no alternative but to search them both.
I don't presume to argue with a clever lawyer like you, but is it quite fair, sir, to Mr. Ablewhite to pass over the opinion of a famous London policeman who investigated this case? Not the shadow of a suspicion rested upon anybody but Miss Verinder. In the mind of Sergeant Cuff.
Do you mean to tell me, Miss Clack, that you agree with the sergeant?
Oh, I judge nobody, sir. And I offer no opinion.
And I commit both those enormities, ma'am. I judge the sergeant to have been utterly wrong. If he had known Rachel's character as I know it, he would have suspected everybody in the house but her. I admit she has her faults. She is secret and self-willed, but true as steel and high-minded and generous to a fault. If all the evidence pointed one way and nothing but Rachel's word of honour pointed the other, I would take her word before the evidence, lawyer as I am. Strong language, Miss Clack, but I mean it.
She is so absolutely to be relied on as that.
So absolutely to be relied on as that.
Then permit me to inform you, Mr. Bruff, that Mr. Ablewhite was in this house not 2 hours since, and that his entire innocence of all concern in the disappearance of the Moonstone was proclaimed by Miss Verinder herself in the strongest language I have ever heard used by a young lady in my life.
If Rachel has testified to his innocence, I don't scruple to say that I believe in his innocence as firmly as you do. I have been misled by appearances, and I will make the best atonement I can by publicly contradicting the scandal which has assailed your friend wherever I meet with it.
I thank you, Mr. Bruff. But surely there is a conjecture to make which has not occurred to us yet.
Maybe, Miss Clack. I own I don't know what it is.
You mentioned as one of the reasons for suspecting Mr. Ablewhite the fact that he was in the house at the time when the diamond was lost. Permit me to remind you that Mr. Franklin Blake was also in the house at the time the diamond was lost.
You are not so good a lawyer, Miss Clack, as I supposed. You don't know when to let well alone.
I'm afraid I fail to follow you, Mr. Bruff.
You're quite right, ma'am. I have suspected Mr. Ablewhite on grounds which justify suspecting Mr. Blake, too.
Ah.
Very good. Let's suspect them together. It's quite in his character, we will say, to be capable of stealing the Moonstone. Mm. The only question is whether it was in his interest to do so.
Mr. Franklin Blake's debts are matters of family notoriety.
I manage Franklin Blake's affairs, and I beg to inform you that the vast majority of his creditors, knowing his father to be a rich man, are quite content to charge interest on their debts and to wait for their money. There is the first difficulty. Second, I have it on the authority of Lady Verinder herself that her daughter was ready to marry Franklin Blake before that infernal Indian diamond disappeared from the house. So there he was, Miss Clack, with his creditors content to wait, and with the certain prospect before him of marrying an heiress. By all means, consider him a scoundrel, but tell me, if you please, why he would steal the Moonstone.
The human heart is unsearchable. Who is to fathom it?
But why then, supposing he did take the diamond, should Franklin Blake make himself the most prominent person in the house in trying to recover it?
Why, to divert suspicion from himself.
He had no need to divert suspicion because nobody suspected him. No, no, Miss Clack. After what has passed here today between us two, the deadlock in this case is complete. Rachel's own innocence is beyond a doubt. Mr. Ablewhite's innocence is equally certain, or Rachel would never have testified to it. And Franklin Blake's innocence, as you have just seen, unanswerably asserts itself. We are equally sure that somebody has brought the Moonstone to London and that Mr. Looker or his banker is in private possession of it at this moment. It baffles me. It baffles you. It baffles everybody.
My lady's finished with the doctor, if you'd care to come this way.
Oh, thank you, my dear. Miss Clack, shall we?
The signing of the will was a much shorter matter than I had anticipated. In less than 2 minutes, it was all over. Mr. Braff folded up the will and then looked my way, apparently wondering whether I did or did not mean to leave him alone with my aunt. I had a mission of mercy to fulfil, and my bag of precious publications ready on my lap. He uttered a profane expression and withdrew in a violent hurry, and left me mistress of the field.
I hope you won't think yourself neglected, Drusilla. I mean to give you your little legacy, my dear, with my own hand.
Give your attention to this book, dear aunt, and you will give me all I ask. This book, The Serpent at Home, shows how the evil one lies in wait for us in all the most apparently innocent actions of our daily lives. The chapters best adapted to female perusal are Satan in the hairbrush, Satan under the tea table, Satan out of the window, well, and many others. Here's a passage I've marked, Satan among the sofa cushions.
I'm afraid, Drusilla, I must wait till I'm a little better before I can read that. The doctor tells me that I am not so well today. He forbids me to see any strangers, and he orders me, if I read at all, only to read the lightest and the most amusing books.
You might feel stronger, dear, in an hour or two. Or you might wake tomorrow morning with a sense of something wanting, and this volume might be able to supply it. Oh, you will let me leave the book, aunt. The doctor can hardly object to that. And now let me leave you to repose, dear aunt. I will call again tomorrow.
Yes. I'm feeling very tired.
On rising the next morning, the maid at my lodgings announced Lady Verinder's servant to see me. It was the footman, with a parcel under his arm.
My lady's love, miss, and I'm to say that you will find a letter inside this parcel.
Oh. Is this my promised legacy? What will it be? Cast-off clothes, worn-out silver spoons, unfashionable jewellery. My books. Every last precious one.
Dear Drusilla, I have been forced, on doctor's orders, to return these to you, and I dare not disobey my physician.
Once self-supported by conscience, once embarked on a career of manifest usefulness, the true Christian never yields. Neither public nor private influences produce the slightest effect on us when we have once got our mission. Glorious, glorious privilege. And how is it earned? We are the only people who can earn it, for we are the only people who are always right.
Oh, good day, miss.
Good day. Is my aunt at home?
I'm afraid her ladyship's had a bad night and is resting, trying to get a little sleep.
Then I shall wait in the library on the chance of seeing her.
I
have urgent business with my aunt.
Then you'd best come in.
The house was quiet. I suppose Rachel to be at her concert with her party of pleasure seekers, Mr. Godfrey, alas, included. So I eagerly devoted myself to my good works, distributing notes about the silent house. I ran lightly upstairs to scatter my mercies next all over the drawing room floor. But as I entered, I heard a double knock at the street door and the footman rushing to open it.
Upstairs, if you please, sir.
Assuming the visitor to be my aunt's doctor, my own self-respect stood in the way of meeting the person who had insulted me by sending me back my books. I slipped into the bay window and pulled the curtains closed to hide myself. Had I made a mistake? Was it not the doctor, but somebody else? I parted the heavy curtains, the least little morsel in the world, and listened.
I'll do it today.
Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite.
Why have you come up here, Godfrey? Why didn't you go into the library?
Miss Clack is in the library.
Clack in the library? You're quite right. We had much better stop here. Well, what did you say to them?
That your mamma is not at all well today, and that you didn't like leaving her to go to the concert. All expressed a cheering belief that Lady Verinder's disposition would soon pass away.
You don't think it's serious, do you, Godfrey?
Far from it.
I was a little frightened at first, but I think so too. But why have you not gone to the concert?
Oh, don't say that, Rachel. If only you knew how much happier I am here with you.
Do try to get over the habit of paying compliments, Godfrey. Do, to please me.
Successful love may sometimes use the language of flattery, I admit. But hopeless love, dearest, always speaks the truth.
Have you forgotten what we agreed on, Godfrey, when you spoke to me in the country? We agreed that we were to be cousins and nothing more.
I break the agreement every time I see you.
Then don't see me.
It's quite useless. Oh, Rachel, how kindly you told me only the other day that my place in your estimation was a higher place than it had ever been yet. Well, am I mad to build the hopes I do on those dear words? Don't tell me so if I am. Leave me my delusion, dearest. I must have that to cherish and to comfort me if I have nothing else.
Are you really sure, Godfrey, that you are so fond of me as that?
Sure. You know what I was, Rachel. Let me tell you what I am. I have lost every interest in my life but my interest in you. My charitable business is an unendurable nuisance to me. And when I see a ladies' committee now, I wish myself at the uttermost ends of the earth.
You have made your confession. I wonder whether it would cure you of your unhappy attachment to me if I made mine. Would you think, to look at me, that I'm the wretchedest girl living? It's true. What greater wretchedness can there be? To live degraded in your own estimation? That is my life now.
How can you have any reason to speak of yourself in that way?
How can you know that I do not?
I know it because I know you. The disappearance of your precious birthday gift may seem strange. Your unexplained connection with that event may seem stranger still.
Are you speaking of the Moonstone?
I certainly thought that's what you referred to.
I referred to nothing of the sort. If the story of the diamond ever comes to light, it will be known that I accepted a dreadful responsibility. But it will be clear that I did nothing mean. Oh, you have misunderstood me, Godfrey. It's my fault for not speaking more plainly. I will be plainer now. Suppose you were not in love with me. Suppose you were in love with some other woman.
Yes.
Suppose you discovered that woman to be utterly unworthy of you. Suppose you were quite convinced that it was a disgrace to you to waste another thought on her. And suppose, in spite of all that, you still couldn't tear her from your heart. And that's the breath of my life, Godfrey. And it's the poison that kills me both in one. He doesn't know. He never will. Don't ask me his name. I have dropped to my right place in your estimation, haven't I?
Oh, noble creature. You have spoken, dearest, of your place in my estimation. Judge what that place is when I implore you, on my knees, to let the cure of your poor wounded heart be my care, Rachel. Will you honour me? Will you bless me by being my wife.
Godfrey, you must be mad.
Is your happiness to be sacrificed to a man who has never known how you feel towards him and whom you are resolved never to see again? No. A heart that loves and honours you, a home whose peaceful claims win gently on you day by day. Try the consolation, Rachel, which is to be found there. I don't ask for your love. I will be content with your affection and regard. Let the rest be left to time that heals even wounds as deep as yours.
Don't tempt me, Godfrey. I am wretched enough and reckless enough as it is.
At your age and with your attractions, is it possible for you to sentence yourself to a single life? Nothing is less possible. You may marry some other man some years hence, or you may marry the man who is now at your feet and who prizes your respect and admiration above the love of any other woman on the face of the earth.
Gently, Godfrey. Oh, I tell you, I am miserable enough and desperate enough, if you say another word, to marry you on your own terms. Take the warning and go.
I won't even rise from my knees till you have said yes.
You won't hurry me, Godfrey.
My time shall be yours.
You won't ask me for more than I can give.
Oh, my angel. I only ask you to give me yourself.
Take me.
Shall I speak to your dear mother, or will you?
Let my mother hear nothing until she's better. I wish it to be kept a secret for the present. Go now, and come back this evening. We have been alone together quite long enough. Who's drawn those curtains? The room is close enough as it is, without keeping the air out of it in that way.
She advanced to the curtains. At the moment when the discovery of me appeared quite inevitable, the door to the room was flung open.
Miss Rachel, please to come downstairs, miss. My lady has fainted and we can't bring her to again.
I was alone. And free to go downstairs in my turn, quite unobserved. Mr. Godfrey passed me in the hall, hurrying out to fetch the doctor.
Go in and help them.
I found Rachel on her knees by the sofa, with her mother's head on her bosom. One look at my aunt's face, knowing what I knew, was enough to warn me of the dreadful truth. Lady Verinder was no more. At a later hour, I peeped into the breakfast room in the library. My aunt had died without opening a single one of the letters which I had addressed to her. I was so shocked at this. But it never occurred to me until some days afterwards that she'd also died without giving me my little legacy.
The funeral of Lady Verinder was a dignified and sad affair. That she had been much loved and respected was reflected in the genuine outpourings of grief from many of those present. On Lady Verinder's death, her will was placed in the hands of my proctor to be proved, as the phrase is, in the usual way. In about 3 weeks from that time, I happened to be looking in at my friend the proctor's office, and I observed that he received me with an appearance of greater interest than usual.
Ah, Mr. Bruff, I have some news for you. What do you think I heard at Doctor's Commons this morning? Lady Verinder's will has been asked for and examined already.
News indeed. There's absolutely nothing which could be contested in the will, and there's nobody I can think of who would have the slightest interest in examining it. Who asked for the will?
Mr. Smalley, of the firm of Skip and Smalley. He looked it over carefully and made a note in his pocketbook.
Smalley, eh? I know him well.
As do I. So I took the liberty of asking him why he found it necessary to examine Lady Verinder's will. He informed me he was acting under instructions from a client and added that it would be a breach of professional confidence to say any more.
Sadly, that much is true.
So I took the unwarrantable advantage of my position and said, choose, sir, between the risk of losing your client's business and the risk of losing that of Mr. Matthew Brough's chambers, which, as you know, is of no little consequence to Messrs. Skip and Smalley.
Quite indefensible.
Well, I quite agree. Without a moment's hesitation, he gave up the name of his client. Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite.
So, you know of my surprise and distress at the news of Miss Ferrander's proposed marriage.
I do.
I was grieved when I heard she was about to throw herself away on Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite. Now here he is, a man I have always believed to be a smooth-tongued impostor, justifying the very worst that I have thought of him, and plainly revealing the mercenary object of the marriage on his side.
And he will now know that neither Miss Rachel nor her husband can raise sixpence on her properties.
Exactly. They would have the houses in London and in Yorkshire to live in, and they would have a handsome income, and that is all. I wonder, will Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite hold to his engagement after what his lawyer has discovered for him?
Depends. Does he stand in urgent need of realizing a large sum of money by a given time?
I don't know. But it would not in the least surprise me. Not in the least.
I am glad to see you, Drusilla. I have been in the habit of speaking very foolishly and very rudely to you on former occasions. I beg your pardon. And I hope you will forgive me.
With all my heart, Rachel, dear.
You know that my uncle, Mr. Ablewhite Sr., has been appointed my guardian.
I do.
And he has consented to the hiring of a house in Brighton.
Oh.
In which I may reside for the present. Now, there is a question of hiring of servants to be dealt
with. Would you like me to undertake to meet that difficulty, dear?
Oh, Drusilla, would you?
Gladly. Has the house been found yet?
Yes, Godfrey has taken it. But he has settled nothing regarding the servants.
I will go to Brighton tomorrow.
Oh, how extremely kind of you. We will join you as soon as you're ready for us. And you will stay, I hope, as my guest.
Oh.
Brighton is so lively. You are sure to enjoy it.
It was then the middle of the week. By Saturday afternoon, the house was ready for them. Between 6 and 7, the travellers arrived. To my indescribable surprise, they were escorted not by Mr. Godfrey, but by the lawyer, Mr. Brough.
How do you do, Miss Clack? I mean to stay this time.
I thought Mr. Godfrey was coming.
Here, the third in the party, Aunt Ablewhite, Mr. Godfrey's mother, spoke up.
Godfrey was very much vexed, Drusilla, not to be able to come with us. There was something in the way which kept him in town. Mr. Brough volunteered to take his place and make a holiday of it till Monday morning.
Rachel stood silent at a window by herself with her eyes fixed on the sea.
Tired, love?
No, only a little out of spirits. I have often seen the sea on our Yorkshire coast with that light on it. And I was thinking, Drusilla, of the days that can never come again.
Oh.
The next morning, Rachel and I went alone together to church. On our return, we found Aunt Ablewhite and Mr. Brough at luncheon.
Will you eat something, Rachel?
No, thank you, Aunt. I have a headache.
Ah, there is only one remedy for a headache. A walk, Miss Rachel, is the thing to cure you. I am entirely at your service, if you will honour me by accepting my arm.
With the greatest pleasure. A walk is the very thing I was longing for.
May I speak to you about your marriage engagement?
Yes, if you have nothing more interesting to talk about.
May I venture to ask whether your heart is set on this marriage?
I am marrying in despair, Mr. Brough, on the chance of dropping into some sort of stagnant happiness which may reconcile me to my life.
Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite can hardly be of your way of thinking. His heart must be set on the marriage at any rate.
He says so. And I suppose I ought to believe him.
It sounds strangely to hear you speak of your future husband as if you were not quite sure of the sincerity of his attachment. Are you conscious of any reason for doubting him?
Mr. Brough, you have something to tell me about Godfrey. Tell it.
Very well. Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite has had his lawyers secretly go over your late mother's will.
To what end?
Why, to ascertain the financial settlements contained within. There could be no other reason.
So? I owe much already to your kindness. And I feel more deeply indebted to it now than ever. If you hear any rumours of my marriage when you get back to London, contradict them at once, on my authority.
Have you resolved to break your engagement?
Can you doubt it, after what you've told me?
Then I recommend that you tell Mr. Godfrey that he has, to your certain knowledge, betrayed the mercenary nature of the motive on his side. And if he should attempt to deny the facts, then please refer him to me.
Thank you for your kind advice, but it is impossible for me to follow it.
May I ask why?
I have believed in that man. I have promised to marry him. How can I disgrace him in the eyes of the world after that? The shame of it would be nothing to him. But the shame of it would be unendurable to me. I shall say that I have thought it over and that I am satisfied it will be best for both of us if we part.
No more than that.
No more.
Have you thought of what he may say on his side?
He may say what he pleases. My mind is made up.
When they returned from their walk, I had never seen Rachel so silent and so thoughtful. And I have never seen Mr. Brough pay her such devoted attention. He had an engagement for dinner that day and took an early leave of us all. Rachel then retired to her room for the rest of the evening. When her cup of tea went up to her the next morning, I followed it in. Do you know, love, I had an odd fancy yesterday about Mr. Brough. I thought when I saw you after your walk with him that he'd been telling you some bad news.
Oh, quite the contrary. It was news I was interested in hearing, and I'm deeply indebted to Mr. Brough for telling me of it.
I suppose, my dear Rachel, that must be news of Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite.
I shall never marry Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite.
What do you possibly mean? The marriage is considered by the whole family as a settled thing.
Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite is expected here today. Oh. Wait till he comes and you will see.
But my dear Rachel...
Penelope?
Rachel!
Penelope, my bath. My dismissed.
Dear girl! Oh, Rachel! After breakfast, I went for a walk. On my return, I entered the dining room, always empty at that time of day, and found myself face to face with Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite.
Oh, yeah! My dear Miss Clack, I have been only waiting to see you. Oh. Chance set me free of my London engagements today sooner than I had expected, and I have got here, in consequence, earlier than my appointed time.
Have you seen Rachel yet?
I have seen Rachel. You are aware, dear friend, that she was engaged to me? Yeah. Well, she has taken a sudden resolution to break the engagement. Reflection has convinced her that she will best consult her welfare and mine by retracting a rash promise and leaving me free to make some happier choice elsewhere.
Well, what have you done on your side? Have you submitted?
Yes, yes, I have submitted. Oh. I have lost a beautiful girl, an excellent social position and a handsome income, and I have submitted to it without a struggle. Oh. What can be the motive for such extraordinary conduct as that, huh? My precious friend, there is no motive.
No motive?
I don't know why I made a proposal of marriage to Miss Verinder. What do I want with Miss Verinder? She's told me with her own lips that she loves another man and that her only idea in marrying me is to try to put that other man out of her head.
Oh,
what a horrid union is this. I approached Rachel with the feeling of a criminal who is going to receive his sentence. When I found that she has changed her mind too, I experienced a most overpowering sense of relief. I feel like a lost man emerging from the darkness into the light.
And I can assure you of a loving reception at the Mother's small clothes, Mr. Godfrey. You will be received as a Christian hero.
Oh,
Sorry, sir.
Clear
the table for lunch.
Lunch already? How the time flies with you, Miss Clack. I shall barely catch the train.
Oh, why such a hurry?
There are family difficulties which need to be reconciled. My father is coming here either this evening or tomorrow. I must tell him what has happened between Rachel and me. Best and dearest of friends, we shall meet again.
Mr. Ablewhite Sr. arrived the next morning, followed some minutes later, to my astonishment, by an unexpected complication in the shape of Mr. Bruff.
Mr. Bruff, this is a pleasant surprise, sir. Oh,
thank you, madam.
When I left your office yesterday, I didn't expect to have the honour of seeing you at Brighton today.
It occurred to me that I might be of some use on this occasion and was just in time to catch the train.
Rachel, my dear, I have heard some extraordinary news from Godfrey. May we discuss the matter in private together?
Whatever you wish to say to me can be said here.
Very well. Some weeks ago, you did my son the honour to engage yourself to marry him. Is it possible that he can have misinterpreted what you really said to him?
Certainly not. I did engage myself to marry him.
Oh, I begin to see it now. You and he have had a lover's quarrel, and my foolish son has interpreted it seriously.
Nothing in the least like a quarrel took place. If he told you that I proposed breaking off our engagement, and that he agreed on his side, he told you the truth.
I am to understand, then, that your engagement is indeed broken off?
Yes, sir, if you please.
I am also to take it that the proposal to withdraw from the engagement came, in the first instance, from you?
That is correct.
Then I beg to ask, Miss Verinder, what complaint you have to make of my son?
You're not bound to answer that question.
Oh, don't forget, sir, that you're a self-invited guest here. Your interference would have come with a better grace if you'd waited until it was asked for.
Thank you, Mr. Bruff, for your advice.
What has my son done? I have a right to know that.
You have had the only explanation which I think it necessary to give to you or to him. I have no more to say.
Well, I have something more to say on my side. I have to say that if my son doesn't feel this insult, I do.
Husband, control yourself.
Insult? What do you mean?
Insult. I know your motive, Miss Verinder, for breaking your promise to my son. I wasn't good enough for the Herncastles when I married, and now it comes to the pinch. My son isn't good enough for you. You've got the Herncastle blood in you, my young lady. I suspected it all along.
A very unworthy suspicion. I'm astonished that you have the courage to acknowledge it.
How dare you!
Surely this is beneath notice. If he can think in that way, let us leave him to think as he pleases.
Rachel, this is not what he truly thinks.
Yes, Mr. Ablewhite, one word. As an affectionate well-wisher, as a friend, and as one long accustomed to arouse, convince, prepare, enlighten, and fortify others, permit me to take the most pardonable of all liberties, the liberty of composing your mind. Now,
Who asked this impudent fanatic into the house?
Miss Clack is here as my guest.
Oh, Miss Clack is here as your guest in my house.
You appear to forget that you took this house as Miss Verinder's guardian for Miss Verinder's use.
Not quite so fast. I have a last word to say which I should have said some time since. If this rampant spinster, Clack, had not interrupted us. I beg to inform you, so that if my son is not good enough to be Miss Verinder's husband, I cannot presume to consider his father good enough to be Miss Verinder's guardian. In your legal phrase with regard to Lady Verinder's will, I decline to act. This house has been hired in my name. It is my house. I can keep it or let it just as I please. I've no wish to hurry Miss Verinder. On the contrary, I beg her to remove her guest and her luggage at her own entire convenience.
Oh. Rachel, my dear, give me your hand. I should be ashamed of my husband if I didn't know that it is his temper which has spoken to you and not himself.
If I may be permitted to answer for Miss Verinder, might I ask you, Mrs. Ablewhite, leave us 10 minutes together, and you may rely on my setting matters right to your satisfaction, as well as to Rachel's.
Very good, Mr. Bruff. I thank you.
Ah, the Herncastle blood has its drawbacks, I admit, but there is something in good breeding, after all. My dear young lady,
Mr. Ablewhite's conduct has naturally shocked you and taken you by surprise. Will you honour Mrs. Brough and me by becoming our guest? And will you remain under my roof and be one of my family until we wise people have laid our heads together and have settled what is to be done next?
Mr. Brough!
Please to resume your seat or leave the room, miss. Well, Rachel, my dear.
Mr. Brough, your kindness towards me is warmly received, as is your offer.
Stop! I must be heard. Mr. Brough, you are not related to her, and I am. I invite her, and I summon the executors to appoint me guardian. Rachel, dearest Rachel, I offer you my modest home. Come to London by the next train, love, and share it with me.
You are very kind, Drusilla. I shall hope to visit you whenever I happen to be in London. But I have accepted Mr. Brough's invitation, and I think it will be best for the present, if I remain under Mr. Brough's care.
Oh, don't say so. I can't part with you. Rachel, I can't part with you.
Surely please, this is a very unnecessary display of agitation. I don't understand it.
No more do I.
Rachel, haven't you seen yet that my heart yearns to make a Christian of you? Has no inner voice told you that I am trying to do for you what I was trying to do for your dear mother when death snatched her out of my hands?
I don't understand your reference to my mother, Miss Clack. Will you have the goodness to explain yourself?
You had better not pursue the subject, my dear, and Miss Clack had better not explain herself.
Do you understand the repercussions which follow from the awful calamity of dying unprepared? Do you know nothing of the flames of hell, of the eternal torment that awaits even the kindliest soul who dies unprepared to face her maker?
Come away, Mr. Brough. Come away, for God's sake, before that woman can say any more. Oh, think of my poor mother's harmless, useful, beautiful life. And that wretch stands there and tries to make me doubt that my mother, who was an angel on earth, is an angel in heaven now. Come away. It stifles me to breathe the same air with her. It frightens me to feel that we are in the same room together.
I am shocked and grieved, but needless to say, not offended. May your hard heart be softened. I freely forgive you.
Come away, Mr. Brough.
You had better not have explained yourself, Miss Clack.
I was left alone in the room. Reviled by them all, deserted by them all. Is there more to be added to this plain statement of facts? To this touching picture of a Christian persecuted by the world? No. From that day forth, I never saw Rachel Verinder again. She had my forgiveness at the time when she insulted me. She has had my prayerful good wishes ever since. And when I die, to complete the return on my part of good for evil, she will have my library of precious tracts left her as a legacy by my will.
After the falling out with Mr. Ablewhite Sr., Miss Verinder found the quiet and repose which she sadly needed, poor thing, in my house at Hampstead. About a week after Miss Verinder had left us, I was visited at my office by a strange Indian gentleman, whose card informed me that he had been recommended to me by Mr. Septimus Looker. He first took out a jewelled casket wrapped in cloth of gold and placed it on my desk.
I have come, sir, to ask you to lend me some money, and I leave this as an assurance to you that my debt will be paid back.
Well, Mr. Looker is quite mistaken in sending you here. I never lend to strangers, and I never lend on such a security as you have produced. I'm sorry.
Supposing, sir, it had been possible for you to lend me the money, in what space of time would it have been customary for me to pay it back?
You would have been entitled to pay the money back in 1 year's time from the date at which it was first advanced to you.
Thank you for your time, sir.
It was clear to me he had a special purpose in asking me this last question. The casket and the application for the loan were mere formalities designed to pave the way for the parting inquiry. What did it mean? I had a dinner engagement that evening, and the prominent personage among the guests I found to be Mr. Murthwaite. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Murthwaite, you were acquainted with the late Lady Verinder, and you took some interest in the strange succession of events which ended in the loss of the Moonstone.
I was, Mr. Brough. Tell me, have you heard anything lately of the Indians?
One of them had an interview with me in my office, on the pretext of asking for a loan he knew I would not give. He was anxious to know the time at which a borrower of money is usually privileged to pay the money back. I've not the slightest idea why.
When do we suppose, at a rough guess, that the diamond found its way into the moneylender's hands?
Towards the end of last June.
And we are now in the year 48. Very good. If the unknown person who has pledged the Moonstone can redeem it in a year, the jewel will be in that person's possession again at the end of June 49. I shall be thousands of miles away from England and the English news at that date, but it may be worth your while to take a note of it and to arrange to be in London at the time.
You think something serious will happen?
I think I shall be safer among the fiercest fanatics of Central Asia than I should be if I cross the door of the bank with a Moonstone in my pocket. The Indians have been defeated twice running, Mr. Brough. It's my firm belief that they won't be defeated a third time.
In episode 3 of The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, Miss Clack was played by Marcia Warren, Mr. Brough by Bill Patterson, Lady Verinder by Eleanor Bron, Rachel Verinder by Jasmine Hyde, and Godfrey Ablewhite by Mark Straker. Mr. Ablewhite Sr. was played by Geoffrey Whitehead, Mr. Murthwaite by Paul Bhattacharjee, Penelope by Claire Corbett, the Indian by Narinda Samra, and Aunt Ablewhite by Carolyn Pickles. The Moonstone was recorded on location by Lucinda Mason Brown, with original music by David Chilton. It was dramatised by Doug Lucy and produced by Janet Whittaker. The Moonstone was a Goldhawk Essential production for BBC Radio 4.
And episode 4 is at the same time next Sunday. After the news, it's Book Club. James Naughtie talks to Tim Butcher about his best-selling Blood River. That's in a couple of minutes.
The Arctic is home to the Inuit, but it's exploited by many others.
Where southerners could get access, they ripped the resources from the ground and dumped their waste, with little thought for local people or the environment.
With the ice melting, the international rush to mine the Arctic is heating up.
Russia is the largest Arctic power. They know it, and they want us to know it.
BBC Radio 4 asks how the native people will fit into the development plans. Costing the Earth, this Wednesday night at 9:00.